It's The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd, and it's Friday, which means it's time for the news roundup. Top stories this week include an announcement that State Senator Dan Wolf has suspended his campaign for governor, and Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey are calling for an expanded emergency plan for Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. We'll also hear about an innovative new wastewater treatment system being tried out here on the Cape, and the first confirmed sighting of a bobcat since colonial times. With me here in the studio to talk about all of this is Anne Brennan, Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times. Welcome.
Morning, Heather.
And Laura Reckford, founder and editor of Cape Cod Wave.
Morning, Heather.
All right. Dan Wolf, it's what everybody's talking about, everybody's reading about. State Senator, the State Ethics Commission has said that his holdings in Cape Air cause a conflict of interest, and he's been fighting this and finally announced yesterday that he's actually suspending his campaign for the governorship and will step down as of August 29th if this is not resolved.
Right. This is something that began to unfold on August 2nd. Dan Wolf announced his intentions to run for governor in July, and about 3 weeks later, he got a call from the Ethics Commission. He had actually talked to the Ethics Commission last spring, saying, you know, he had done it in 2010 when he was considering running for Senate. And then again, he said, out of caution to the commission in the spring because the governor has different types of powers than a senator. And he essentially didn't hear anything back from them other than they called to confirm how much of an ownership he had in Cape Air. He's the CEO of Cape Air and continues to be. And he got a call on August 2nd saying that the contracts Cape Air holds with Massport in order for Cape Air to use Logan Airport present a conflict of interest. One, because he owns more than 10% of his company, and two, because the contracts are no-bid contracts. He contends that those contracts it's the same contract for any certified airline that uses Logan Airport. They're not negotiable. The federal government sets the terms, and they're automatically renewed. So he has been saying since the 2nd, this isn't a conflict, but apparently the commission, it doesn't. He wants to push the issue. If you're not going to reverse it, then I might as well step down.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, he's been in the Senate for 2 years now, and this first came up in 2010, as you said. I can see suspending his campaign for governorship because of this decision about the relationship between the governor's office and Massport, but how does that end up with him stepping down from the Senate as well?
Well, when he got the call from the commission on August 2nd, they told him, you're in conflict of interest because of these contracts, and you have three choices. You can divest from Cape Air, you can in the contracts between Cape Air and Massport, which would then Cape Air could no longer fly into Logan Airport. So it would really hurt the company.
Right. The story this week was saying, you know, he'd also said that he was contemplating divesting.
If he became governor, he would consider divesting or maybe putting his company in a blind trust or something like that.
But now he's saying that would put the company in such a bind that he's not going to divest. Instead, he's going to suspend his campaign for the governorship.
Right. I think that the third thing that they told him was you could resign from the Senate. So those were his three choices. But so he's saying, okay, I'm going to resign from the Senate because if he runs for governor and wins, maybe there are things he can be putting into place that ease the divestment of the company or to put it in a blind trust or something. It's an employee-owned company. If he sells all his stock at once, it would create debt for those still owning the company. And that's what he was saying.
So his resignation wouldn't be completely bowing out of politics. It's kind of a strategic move that might buy him time to get back into the governor's
race.
Well,
he's saying that I think that what's going on is he was into the Cape Cod Times a few weeks ago, and we asked him, is this hampering your ability to raise money, which it is, and he admitted that it is causing problems there. The other thing is, this is what he's talking about now, is this ethics question, and he wants to be talking about how, you know, what to do about the 80% of the people who are not part of the economic recovery and other things. And so I think the combination of those two things probably went into his decision, as well as that these were the three choices that were laid out to him, three options.
I think one thing that's interesting here is you can file it under no publicity is bad publicity. I mean, he now essentially is really a statewide candidate. Everyone knows about him, and maybe even it might go, some of the news might go national at this point. So it's very interesting. And also the fact that his whole persona is about being very forthright and progressive, and then he's coming in as this liberal businessman, this unusual thing of he's not a career politician, he's a businessman, and he has supporters like Bill Zammer writing a letter to the editor in the Cape Cod Times this week, who's a Republican, saying he supports him. So very interesting candidate to begin with, and to have this sort of ethics cloud, which and he portrays it as going into it with, which is a common phrase, with an abundance of caution, I think is how he put it, to ask, was this okay? Thinking it would be okay, of course, and then having it not be okay. And then that he doesn't seem to want to challenge that legally. And I guess it's a matter of one doesn't challenge the Ethics Commission.
Because it doesn't look good to challenge
the ethics. It doesn't look
good to be pushing the boundary of ethics.
Particularly if you consider yourself an ethical person. So it's really, he's in a bit of a bind, but I think that this move, I think we can almost look at it as a strategic move.
Do you think he's gotten any sympathy out of this, any public sympathy?
I would say so. I mean, I think everyone's talking about it.
Well, Common Cause came out and said, the whole notion that he's in conflict of interest over contracts that are no-bid contracts when nobody's bidding on them. It's the federal, they're regulated by the federal government. They're agreements that any certified airline has to be able to have, is able to have access to Logan Airport.
Right.
So it's not that there's any favoritism. It's like he likens it to using the turnpike. You don't go up to the toll booth and start dickering over, well, could I pay 50 cents instead of,
a
dollar?
Might like to sometimes, but it doesn't really fly.
But you know what I mean? And so it's kind of weird in that way. But for the commission's part, they said that back in 2010, they said, if you have contracts, let us know. And they're saying he announced for governor prematurely, that they hadn't finished with their decision. Laura says, I think he's in a little bit of a no-win situation, because here's a candidate who essentially nobody really knew except for this part of the state, who now has this ethics question over his head. And that's the coverage that's being, a lot of the coverage now. So if somebody doesn't know who he is, and there's this question, that can work against him. And then if he goes ahead and goes to court, there's another almost tainting of a personality. So it's really an interesting situation, but it may work to his advantage. He certainly has had people coming out and saying, like Common Cause, the Boston Globe has written editorials saying this is the kind of candidate we're looking for, who does have business. He sits on a subcommittee of the Federal Reserve Bank and is on other a bank board and other things that in addition to being a CEO. So we'll see what happens.
It's not like this Ethics Commission hasn't had the best reputation anyway. You don't want to ruffle the feathers of the Ethics Commission in one way, but they've kind of, there's been a lot of criticism of this Ethics Commission for not being strong enough, not being tough enough. And so they kind of are in a no-win situation, too.
Well, that's the funny thing about it. It's usually the other side of the coin. I mean, as journalists, and we know as journalists that they do take a long time, first of all, but also that that they typically, we're wondering why they're not looking into things. And but the other side of this story with Dan Wolf is that there was a back and forth on the story a little bit, where he said he hadn't heard from them and they said, wait a minute, we did let you know. And he said, well, that memo went to one of my aides. So there was that little problem. And you would think that if a memo comes from the Ethics Commission, of all things, and obviously a lot of things are coming over his desk, that would be really very important, and not to give to someone else.
Well, yeah, the email was about when he went to the Senate, he had a scheduler at Cape Air. And he wanted to have that scheduler work part-time for Cape Air and part-time for his Senate, so it would be a state employee essentially. So he sent an email asking, can we do this? The email that they sent back that, you know, gave the ruling that it said, you know, you can do this, you got to watch out for this and that. And by the way, if you have contracts with the state, that could be a conflict of interest. And so he's saying that it was the subject head was about the scheduler, and he passed it on thinking that that's what it was about. I think that he even admits that, well, and he did admit it to us, that he wished he had done more due diligence getting things in writing. But I also want to say that the current executive director at the commission was formerly a chief assistant counsel at Massport, who is dealing with these contracts, not maybe these specific contracts, but dealing with contracts at Massport, and must be very familiar with them and what, right. You know, the whole, you know, it's kind of a hybrid of a no-bid contract. But the other thing is, Randy Hunt, the Sandwich state rep, he also chimed in and said, you know, the governor appoints the board at Massport, and that would definitely be an issue that could be a conflict. And that's when Dan Wolf was saying, look, if I become governor, then I will have to make a decision about my company. But he says the commission shouldn't be in the business of telling people who can and cannot run for governor. If I run for governor and then they say there's a conflict, then we deal with it. At that point, it shouldn't be picking and choosing who can run and who can't run.
Well, certainly not the last we're going to hear of that story.
Right. They meet again on September 20th, I believe. And he said that he wanted to appeal this ruling, and we'll see what happens.
All right. A report this week about the state crime lab scandal ups the number of cases potentially affected to, I think, 40,000 from a previous 34,000 estimate. And obviously a number of those are on the Cape. So what's the situation at this point?
Well, this was a press conference by David Meyer earlier this week. He was the attorney that was appointed by Governor Deval Patrick to review all the prosecutions connected with drugs and other evidence that was that were processed by Annie Dukin, who is a chemist at the state laboratory and who has been charged with tampering with evidence and actually obstructing justice and perjury. And in looking at these cases, as you said, they initially thought there were about 34,000 people involved whose cases were impacted. They're saying it's more like 40. And of those 40,000, 10,000 people were still incarcerated, and they are looking at those cases first and have been looking at those cases first. The remaining 30,000, many of them are involved first-time defendants who have nonviolent no associated convictions with violent crimes. And so they're trying to figure out, what do we do with these cases? Many of them, people have already served their time or their, you know, probation. Do we go back and retry these cases? Or is it better and more cost effective to maybe start just dismissing them? That's the what people saying, the rights of the people who have been charged, that maybe this is the better course to go. I don't think a decision has been made. But on the Cape, there have been about 17 cases that, 76 cases that have been revisited so far. Of those, 32 have been resolved completely. 17 people had their convictions, their sentences stayed, and three of them went back to jail for violating those stays.
I thought that was an interesting. They were trying to do the justice system trying to do the right thing and stayed their sentences, but they violated judges' orders and ended up back in prison anyway, whether or not they were.
Right.
The tampering had affected their original conviction.
This has not been inexpensive. It's so far they've spent about $10 million of the $30 million that the governor set aside for looking into these cases. And David Mayer is charging, is getting paid about $12,500 a month to look through these cases. It's very time consuming. And So far in the state, the 337 prison inmates have been released and 1,115 cases have been dismissed or not prosecuted. So we'll have to see what happens in the future.
Yeah, well, you know, they said that Michael O'Keefe, the district attorney, said that, well, we kind of already knew what number of cases were going to be affected on Cape Cod. We'd done our own tallying
right.
of that. So this wasn't really a surprise, but we're still waiting for a report on the general health and status of the rest of the crime lab, not just Annie Dugan.
Right.
And that's kind of ominous sounding.
Well, the inspector general was requested to look into what happened and to look into how evidence in general is being handled and processed, and to make sure that there's safety mechanisms in place to make sure that this doesn't happen again, but also to see what's, you know, as Michael Keefe said, the health of the system. And that report was supposed to be due last week, so it could come any day now.
Actually, Barnstable Police Chief Paul McDonald was talking to a civic association last week, and this question came up, and he said it's been absolutely devastating for their department, that as you would expect, they have the majority of these cases. And Deputy Chief Craig Tamish was with them at this talk, and Deputy Chief Tamish said this thing about there has been a bit of a revolving door with some of them who've been let out and have gone back in, but they're still really bearing the brunt of this, and that they'll know about many more cases, they believe, that have to do with this, and they're just trying to pick up the pieces, essentially, from this. It's been a catastrophe for their department.
It's the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd. I'm talking this week with Anne Brennan of the Cape Cod Times and Laura Reckford of Cape Cod Wave. Cape activists, Lyme disease activists this week, got a real boost from a report that came out, and pretty scary, said that Lyme disease is actually 10 times more common than previously reported by the Centers for Disease Control.
Right. They're saying that there are about 300,000 cases annually, as opposed to the 20 to 30,000 that are listed on the Centers for Disease Control website. What happened was, when somebody is diagnosed with Lyme disease, doctors are supposed to fill out all these forms and send them in to, I guess, the CDC. And it takes a lot of time to do that. And sometimes doctors there's a high level also of different types of tests and things.
Well, say there's like blood testing to confirm
right.
it, which I know from personal experience around here, a lot of doctors don't bother. They figure there's so many ticks around with Lyme disease. You got bit, you've got some symptoms, let's test it. They don't bother to do a confirming blood test.
Right, and take the doxycycline. So what they did was, there was a study done that they, of seven national laboratories, a national patient survey, and a review of insurance information, which revealed this much higher number of cases. And now a lot of people who, especially on the Cape, who have been saying there's a lot more cases than are being reported, are really hoping that because of this level of disease, that now there'll be more emphasis put on prevention, as well as doing research into how to better treat Lyme disease, which is also, the treatments have also been very controversial in some cases, with insurance companies not, some doctors want to give a longer term of antibiotics, and insurance companies are saying, no, that's not a treatment that we cover. There's been a lot of controversy there as well.
Yeah, I think the most stunning number there was for this discrepancy between the confirmed cases and the cases being treated is that in 2010 on Martha's Vineyard, island health officials said there were more than 1,500 people who got the doxycycline and essentially were treated for Lyme disease, but there were only 25 cases that got that confirmed status. I mean, that's a huge discrepancy.
And, you know, if you have that many cases, it really is a public health
very much so, yeah.
issue that has come up. And this kind of underground nature of this disease, making it look like it's smaller numbers, it probably isn't getting the attention on a research level that it would, that other diseases that are more prevalent do.
I guess one thing that certainly happened is we're way beyond the point of, does Lyme disease exist? I mean, so now we're
it's true. There was the debate was 5 years ago. Yeah,
so we're way beyond that, and we all know that the islands are the play, but Nantucket in particular and Martha's Vineyard, very, very frequent that people get concerned about that, and then of course on the Cape also. I think we all know people who have said, "Oh no, I think I got bitten by a tick," and rushing to the doctor, and it's very frequent. So that word is out that people have to be careful. So we should be grateful for that, and then the next step, as Anne said, are these various things about learning more about the disease.
Yeah, and if it's not treated, if it's let to continue, there can be real problems with that, neurocognitive damage.
It could be much worse if you don't get yourself to the doctor. I think people have that message. That message has been received.
Yeah, right.
So definitely a boost in awareness, and hopefully that will translate into some more treatments on their way. Now, wastewater. Perennial story here on the Cape, and a little bit of movement this week in a couple of the lawsuits that had been brought by the Conservation Law Foundation and Coalition for Buzzards Bay against the EPA.
Right. There was a court hearing earlier this week in federal court. It's going to continue this morning, but during the hearing last, I think it was Tuesday, the case involves the Conservation Law Foundation and the Buzzards Bay Coalition suing the EPA for two things. One, challenging the EPA's approval of the total maximum limits, which is how much nitrogen may enter the local waters here. There's disagreement. These total maximum limits are being used to decide how the towns around the Cape and other places in southeastern Massachusetts, to what level can they reduce the amount of nitrogen flowing into the aquifer and into area bodies of water? And the CLF disagrees with the EPA on what those levels should be. In addition, they also sued the EPA for failing to live up to a mandate to annually approve the Cape Wastewater Management Plan. In that case, in the wastewater management plan, the state has not updated it at all since 1978. So the EPA is saying, how can you sue us for not approving this every year when there's nothing new? And in that case, Judge Wolf said that if the Cape Cod Commission is now working on a master plan for wastewater plan, and if that is finished and the EPA approves it, then this case might be moot. He didn't rule that, but that was one of his questions. So he advised the two lawyers in the case to maybe go get a drink and talk about this and come back and let him know if they're going to continue to pursue that issue.
I love that recommendation.
And in the other one of the total maximum daily loads, the disagreement there is the judge was questioning, well, where is the damages? You know, is that if you're saying that the water's polluted, who's being hurt? And the CLF folks said, well, we've got affidavits from 2010 of people who are saying they've been damaged, but they weren't entered into the court record because EPA apparently didn't challenge that. And the judge is saying, well, if we're not proving harm, and it would be against court procedures to allow you to now put those affidavits into the record, this might also be a moot point.
So, that case might just get dismissed essentially on technicality.
Right. I can't say what the judge is going to do, but he was hinting by what he was saying in the courtroom that might be the way he goes.
I mean, this whole, go get a drink and come back and talk about it tomorrow suggests that maybe he's a little, I don't know.
He thinks there's some points that maybe it's some agreement.
Some discussion, but that maybe this is not where the court should be,
right.
Should be ruling. He kind of wants them to work it out on their own.
But if he does say that they cannot submit these affidavits, then, and the case is ultimately dismissed, CLF then could refile the lawsuit with those affidavits. So it doesn't mean that it would be an end of it, but just based on what they were saying in court, that's another thing that might happen.
And I think the main point of this case, I don't think there's too much disagreement about this, is that the Conservation Law Foundation wanted to put wastewater back on the front burner here on Cape Cod and get people talking about it and dealing with the issue, and with the Cape Cod Commission taking over the reins and trying to put together a plan, and the different towns still struggling with their various plans, but moving forward step by step. some of what I think they want to accomplish, I think they have. So whether they are definitely wanting this to go all the way through the courts, who knows? I doubt it. I think it was really it was a strategic move again. Perhaps.
It was more just to prod everybody and get things moving a little.
Right. They felt everyone was moving far too slowly.
Yeah.
And the kind of sort of Damocles that hangs over the Cape with this is that if the court rules in favor of CLF, then the court could mandate this, you know, sewers or whatever it is to reduce the amount of nitrogen, which is what happened with the Boston Harbor cleanup, where they filed suit and the court took over and the court said, this is what you have to do. And that leaves municipalities with little wiggle room in terms of how much this is going to cost and how they're going to pay for it. So once the lawsuit was filed, it was kind of a warning, get going. With this issue, or well, you could not be able to control it.
I was a little surprised to read that the state wastewater plan for the Cape hadn't been updated in that long, just because it is such a hot issue. There is so much going on the Cape, and there was another really great story this week of a group in Hyannis, I believe, who's got this just test scale, small scale system where they're actually growing algae to try to treat at least the bay water, not necessarily direct wastewater, but just kind of an interesting example of some of the alternatives that are being tested out here on the Cape.
Right. This is Brian Braginton-Smith, who has Lewis Bay Research Center. And at the Zooquarium, he has put up this little plant as a way to clean, using algae to clean wastewater. And it ends up with chips that could then be used to burn for fuel. And he's got a small-scale model there, and he's seeing how, and this is a technology that apparently is being used in different in the Midwest, Spokane, Ohio, to reduce both phosphorus and nitrogen as a way that's a little more natural. And then there's a byproduct that then can be used to generate energy.
Well, this seems to be really the way the science is going on this, is trying to find a way, maybe over and above sewers or in addition to or working with it, to clean the waters of the Cape out without doing the big pipe system. And this is one method. And I think of John Todd back with New Alchemy 25 years ago, and he's now in Burlington, Vermont, with a similar plant of a living ecosystem where you're cleaning the wastewater in a natural way without using sewers. And so I think the science is maybe, and he may have been a little ahead of his time, but now it's starting to catch up. And I think other people are looking at these methods as the way that we have to go in order to afford the treatment that we need for the estuaries.
Well, and you know, one of the things that I thought was interesting about the story is that they said you would still need essentially the pipes to deliver wastewater to a plant where you had these algal growth systems. But then if you're producing a product out the end, if somebody wants that algae, you know, they're selling it to fertilizer manufacturers and to others. At least if you've got a product coming out the end of your wastewater treatment plant, maybe you've got a little bit of revenue that could help pay for that sewer. You know, that's got to be attractive.
Right. And you're really using everything that you can from the system to recycle.
Right, looking at the waste as a resource as well.
Right.
Now, of course, oysters have been another thing that's come up in the wastewater debate over and over. And Laura, Cape Cod Wave has a story this week about the expansion of oyster fests.
Well, I just thought it was interesting because we all know and we've talked about how successful the Wellfleet Oyster Festival has been over the years. In fact, so successful they're now thinking of charging for it, where it's been a free event because so many people go. And what we sometimes forget is that there are actually other oyster farmers all throughout the Cape. And I noticed this month that I've got a couple of notices of other oyster festivals that were happening. And so it's not going to be just the Wellfleet Oyster Festival anymore. That, in fact, just down the street here at the Woods Hole Historical Museum, they're planning an event for next Friday where they're having a bunch of oyster farmers from the Falmouth area who have grants off Woods Hole, actually, who call themselves Sipawisset Oysters as a group. And there's probably five different farmers. They've banded together in something called the Falmouth Shellfish Cooperative, and they work actually with Coonamesset Farm, where they sort of have a farm-to-table serving their product there, and they also sell to different restaurants, but they're going to do a demonstration of their products at a little mini oyster festival here in Woods Hole next Friday. And then the Barnstable Oyster Farmers, not to be outdone, they're having an event called the Barnstable Oyster Fest later on this month, at September 21st at Long Pond Audubon Sanctuary in Cumaquid. And the idea is that the oysters, which is actually is a sort of a secret of residents of Barnstable, don't want too many people to know that right off in Barnstable Harbor, if you're a resident of the town of Barnstable, you can get a license and go out and basically pick up oysters early in the morning when the tide is low during the season. And they're wonderful. And there are also oyster farmers out there, and they're going to show off their product at this Barnstable Oyster Fest that's coming up later in September. So I just thought it was interesting. We know about Kituit oysters. People talk about those Wellfleet oysters. There are other farms around the Cape, and I think we're going to start hearing more about them as well.
We certainly don't want to detract from Wellfleet's what Wellfleet has going on, but I have tried some of those other oysters, and they're also delicious. So. Best of luck to them.
What Peter Chase, who was the first one to farm oysters off Gansett, he started about 10 years ago, and the others followed suit. That he says that the Sipawisset oysters, they're saltier than the Wellfleet ones, he said. But he said there is a distinct flavor, and he thinks that they're very excellent, and that people will really enjoy trying them out.
All right. On a very different note, Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, another story that can't stay out of the news these days. A shutdown yesterday on the heels of senators calling for an expanded emergency management plan.
Well, the shutdown, I'll start with that first. The shutdown was caused by a tripped breaker that cut off pumps that pump water into the main containment where the nuclear reaction happens. It gets very hot as the fission is going on, so they're constantly circulating water through those through the reactor. They have a backup system, so there was no danger that there was of a meltdown. The backup system kicked in, and then they started to shut down the plant. They're trying to figure out what it was that caused that trip, the breaker to trip, but it's about the second time of unplanned shutdown. You don't like to have unplanned shutdown, but this was shut down manually as opposed to emergency, the plant shuts off, which is a much harsher shutdown on the plant.
Well, and they had one earlier this summer, again, unplanned, but not emergency, when the water temperatures rose too high for them to be using it for cooling.
Right. So the plant provides about 15% of the electricity of Massachusetts. So, but this shutdown, because it is, they say it's the 1.9 unplanned shutdown. I guess they figured that out over so many hours. But this is a level that would then push them into a category of more oversight. There's by the NRC, there's about 100 plants operating in the United States, and 23 of those 100 now are under a more strict oversight. So we'll see if that's going to happen with Pilgrim.
It certainly doesn't instill a lot of confidence when you've got a plant that's already quite controversial and in this relicensing process, and now the controversy about the emergency management plan as well.
Right. The plant has pretty much been controversial since it was built. You know, in the late 70s, there were radiological leaks because of faulty fuel rods. In the mid-80s, it shut down to do some renovations, repipe and other things to make the plant more safe. And there are people like Diane Turco, who are part of the Downwinders, who have been talking about this plant since the 80s. And now their big fight is, and has been, I wrote these stories back in the 80s and early 90s about the evacuation plan. And that was what Senators Markey and Warren sent a letter to the NRC to Entergy, which owns the plant, urging them to increase the emergency evacuation planning for 50 miles around the plant.
That would include the entire Cape at that point.
Which would include the Cape and islands. Instead, because currently under federal law, they are only obligated to do emergency planning to within a 10-mile radius of the plant. It's the senators wrote their letter saying that Entergy is underestimated how many people would from the Cape would be wanting to leave the Cape if there were a radiological emergency. And they say Entergy is saying about 20% of the Cape. But a recent survey that the company did said that more than half of the people they interviewed who live on Cape Cod would try and leave if there were a radiological emergency.
And that was even if they were told not to. It would still be over half. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting because the activists seem to have stepped up their efforts a little bit lately. As Anne said, they've been at it for years, but they've been very active lately, demonstrating and getting arrests and so forth. And then all these things keep happening. And so it remains on the front page. It's an interesting confluence of events, I think.
Definitely.
Well, and I think one of the things that tripped this new kind of higher profile protesting was the Fukushima plant after the tsunami in Japan. It's a similar plant. It's the same manufacturer, the same structure, same type of reactor, with the fuel rod the spent fuel rod pool sitting on top above the reactor. And in that case, the backup systems were in Japan. The backup systems were on the ground. So when the water came in, they didn't work.
Right, they flooded the generator.
Right,
generators.
They're saying here that that's not the case, that the backup, that wouldn't happen here. But it's, I guess that there's just a renewed attention to the fact that there are issues with this plant that may have, that people need to pay attention to. And their goal is to shut down the plant. So while they applauded the letter from the senators, they're saying that we want the plant shut down. And it, as I said, it provides about 15% of the energy to the state. It's not clear that that would happen. In the meantime, the Plymouth selectmen signed a payment in lieu of taxes agreement with the plant that would bring the town $28 million over 3 years because the plant doesn't pay property taxes.
It's the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd, and I'm talking with Anne Brennan of Cape Cod Times and Laura Reckford of Cape Cod Wave. Now, a Cape man is suing to get crash records, confidential documents about TWA Flight 800, Flight 800, which crashed in 1996.
Right. He is suing to get documents from the Missile Defense Agency and the Navy Special Warfare Command, who he has been trying to get information about their investigation and what they were doing at the time that this plane crashed over Long Island Sound back in, I believe it was 1996.
Yeah, and at the time, people watching, you know, it actually exploded. Yeah.
Right.
And there were, I guess, eyewitness accounts that said they thought they saw something come up from the water toward the airplane. So it seemed, I mean, certainly an unusual situation to have a plane crash like that and explode.
Right. Well, Thomas Stalkup agrees with you. He's a Falmouth native and now lives in Sandwich, and he's a physicist and entrepreneur. And he was studying for his PhD when this crash occurred. And he said that he was watching TV when the FBI or whoever it was, or excuse me, probably the NTSB, gave a press conference about what happened to cause this crash. And they said at the time that, and still contend, that it was a spark. There was an electrical spark that traveled back to the central wing fuel tank, and there were fumes there that exploded. There were witnesses who saw, like you say, some type of thing shooting up toward the plane. They explained that by saying there was probably fuel that was burning prior to the explosion that was leaking out of the plane, and it would have been on fire, that's what they saw. But apparently there were also some military exercises going on, and he's trying to find out what these agencies know about that.
Right. So these documents would be basically the lists of all of the military exercises that would have been going on in the area,
and whatever, and maybe if they did any investigation as well. I think the SEALs might have been involved to get some of the debris out of the Navy SEALs to get debris out of the water. And he said what started him down this path was during that press conference, they ran a video that the CIA had produced, which he thought the CIA never talks to anybody, you know. And they said a missile did not cause this plane to crash. I mean, that's probably oversimplifying it. But that really made him wonder, wait a minute, what's going on?
He thought they doth protest too much.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Why would that even come up if it were not the
issue?
And
then later
right.
he was paying attention to the congressional hearings, and a gentleman by the name of Hank Hughes, who was an NTSB investigator on the case, had complained about how the investigation had been handled. So he started sending federal FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act requests, to different agencies, to the NTSB. And he's gotten a lot of information, but he really wants to get this information from the military. And ultimately, he made a documentary. This Hank Hughes was part of that. There were other investigators who, from different agencies, who also questioned how this investigation was done. And he's really trying to get to the bottom of this. The documentary played in Woods Hole earlier this month, and now he's filing suit to try and get the rest of these documents.
All right. The O-Search team has been out on the water looking for great white sharks without too much success, but they did finally this week tag a second great white shark, and she's got a great Cape Cod name. She's Catherine.
Catherine Lee Bates, named after the composer of America the Beautiful. Catherine Lee Bates actually came from Falmouth. And this was a 14-foot, 2-inch female that they caught. They've been using these seal decoys. I guess it's like a gray carpet cut out in the shape of a seal that seems to be helping them more than the chum. But this was an expedition that started out with much fanfare to tag 20 whales in 31 days, whatever came first. And so far we're 3 days into their expedition. They've caught two. They've seen more. But
I love that whole decoy thing. I mean, Greg Scommel has said that for some reason these sharks, our Cape Cod sharks, are very picky, that it's usually not this hard to attract a shark and get them into your area. So maybe the decoy, they're here for the gray seals. Maybe a gray seal decoy is what it takes.
Well, and I kind of wonder, I mean, I don't know anything about this, but they've tagged in excess of 20 over the last 5 or 6 years, and maybe they're telling each other.
They're talking to each other.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is also a very different way of tagging them, though. I mean, a lot of what Greg Scommel and the state biologists have done is just a harpoon and put one tag onto the dorsal fin. This is really quite
catching them, yeah.
Yeah. Quite
it's an interesting was described, the process is very elaborate, and I'm not the first person to point this out, that it's sort of like what people in the 50s thought the Martians were doing with us when they got us. I mean, you take them, you cover them, you put all these things on them and let them out and let's see what they do. And you know, it's a little bit bizarre, but I should say one thing, that Catherine Lee Bates, she was a poet, and I don't think she was very shark-like, but at any rate, if they want to name the shark after her, that's okay, I guess.
Yeah.
But the technology that they're using is pretty interesting, these tags.
It's fascinating. I mean, they're drawing blood, they're actually doing a whole body ultrasound, and they've been catching a lot of females. You know, they're checking to see if they're pregnant and how old the pups would be, where they might have been mating, and then they put 3 tags on their dorsal fins and 1 in the abdominal cavity. I mean, a ton of information that they could be getting back from even just 2 sharks tagged. You know, they've said a couple of times, I think, you know, well, we'd like to tag all catch all 20 that we had, you know, our sights set on, but if we get 2, then that's what we'll take it, and that's better than 0.
Well, it is interesting about how they've learned about the movement of sharks and how they go close to shore and out, you know, kind of in a almost zigzagging motion, and trying to figure out why they go close to shore, because that's when human beings become, you know, imperiled. So it's been interesting.
Yeah, fascinating. All right, and more wildlife. There was the first confirmed sighting of a bobcat on Cape Cod, first time since colonial days that we've actually had a confirmed sighting of one of these.
And this was with the technology of a cell phone.
No infrared cameras, nothing fancy.
No, the headlights of a car and a cell phone. This gentleman came home, and Chris LaBeouf, and he lives on Tenneke Hill Road in Falmouth, and he noticed this creature sitting in his yard. So he put, you know, shined his headlights on and took a picture. It was, I think, around midnight. It's a murky video. I remember when he sent it to us, you really had to watch it to try and see the cat. And it's kind of at the end that you can really see this cat. And wildlife folks are saying, yes, that is indeed a bobcat. They're about the size of a medium-sized dog.
And what they say, about 18 to 20 inches, something
right.
like that. Yeah.
And not not all that threatening. I wouldn't go close to them, but they're not, like, going to attack people. And you were saying before the show that they found some droppings.
Yeah, I think they said there's been evidence over the years. They found droppings somewhere on the Outer Cape a few years ago. But you know, this is the confirmation that we actually have at least one bobcat. It makes you wonder how many
right.
more there might be. And, you know, I think they said that bobcats aren't afraid to walk on roads. It could have just walked over one of the bridges. So maybe it's just a one-off visitor. But
they thought it was a juvenile. It looked like a juvenile bobcat. I don't know how you can tell that, but that's what they, looking at the video, the wildlife folks said. Mm-hmm. So it made me wonder, well, are the parents around? Or, as you say, did it just come over the bridge? Like, the, you know, we've had the bear and fishers have. I remember when the first fisher was seen in a long time.
And I think that was also Falmouth, if I recall, when the first fisher was seen, and maybe there was roadkill first, and then someone saw a live one. But it's funny about when you look at this video, and it really looks like a house cat, but of course, if you're Chris LaBeouf looking at it, he's thinking to himself, that's no house cat.
That's way too big to be a cat.
It's bigger, but it really looks very cat-like. And I guess it was actually when it got spooked, it realized that someone was there, and it turned around and slinked into the bushes. They saw the short tail. And that was really the big tip off, that they don't have that their backside is doesn't look like the typical cat. But I think people had suspected that these animals would get to the Cape pretty soon, because they do see them. They're very common, apparently, in western Massachusetts. And they've been coming eastward for some time, and they've seen them in Carver and so forth. So here we go. Not a huge surprise, perhaps.
I know people get very nervous about having predators near human populations for good reason, but I get really excited by stories like that. I think that's really neat. All right, last but not least, some folks on the Outer Cape are stepping up efforts to try to protect some of our summer workers in particular that are using their bikes a lot.
Right. This is, there is one thing that started out in Chatham at the St. Christopher's Episcopal Church. People were saying there that there's a lot of workers who use their bikes, and there's been a lot of accidents. So they started selling bike lights to people, they purchased bike lights that they would give to workers who came in, and these are lights they would attach to their clothing. But in addition to that, there's other groups, and the police have noticed such an increase in accidents on bikes that they've, Yarmouth, for example, has started pulling bikes over more as an education effort. If you're 16 or younger, you need to have a helmet on by law. Remind people of that. Remind people of what the laws are in terms of the type of lighting and the reflectors that you need on your bike in order to be a legal vehicle. And we ran this story on Monday, and unfortunately, on over the weekend, a 16-year-old boy, Miles Tibbetts, was killed in Wellfleet, crossing the street on his bike, Route 6, and unfortunately wasn't wearing a helmet. But we've had issues where workers who are riding home at night get hit by cars because either they're not lighted, you know, people can't see them.
Well, I mean, we have some of these fabulous bike paths,
right.
But once you're on Cape Cod roads, they're not always very wide. They don't necessarily have a shoulder. It can be pretty perilous for biking.
Right. And I think that in general that, you know, I grew up in California, and the bike paths were really, you know, they had them in place in the 70s. Out here, it's kind of people have been biking, but as a way of transportation, it's relatively new. So there's education that has to go on, not just with the bicyclists, but also with the drivers who are need to share the road.
Well, you can read more about that and the other top news of the week on Cape Cod Times website. I've been talking with Anne Brennan, Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times, and Laura Reckford, Founder and Editor of Cape Cod Wave. Thank you both.
Thank you, Heather.
I'm Heather Goldstone, sitting in for Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.